Welcome, everybody, and happy Mother's Day, mothers. I'm so glad you got your candies. Now you are identified by your pink bows. We know who you are. So, absolutely. I wanted to keep that theme going. You know, we're talking about mothers today, and so I wanted to take the theme of mothers and, of course, put my own personal spin on it. So you know we're going into the cornfield here for a while, and we'll turn around and come back again. But one of the things that I've done for the last couple of years that I really like to do every year, because to me it is fascinating, and I know I'm an egghead, and I apologize for that, but only so much, because it's who I am. But when you get into the Hebrew roots of the words, it is so instructive about what God intended for us as families, in the relationships that we live in our families and in our daily lives. The roots of the words themselves tell us where those roles fall. And we see it played out in our lives all the time. We see it in our own biological wiring. And we wonder, why do we do the things we do? Why are there differences between men and women? And why are those differences often so predictable? You know, it's because these things are hardwired into us. And there's for a reason. Because the family is stable and life is preserved when these roles are lived out. Not slavishly and not in a stereotypical way. But when we're free to really act on who it is that we are and we're created to be. When the Hebrews first started speaking their language and then writing it down, the first ways that they wrote their language was with what was called pictograms. And the pictograms were little pictures of whatever they happened to be. If it was a sunset, if it was an ox's head, if it was a tent, if whatever it was that was common in their lives, they wrote these little pictures. And those became more and more stylized over time. And eventually evolved into the alphabet that we have today. But the pictograms tell us a lot of the story here. For instance, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet is Aleph. And Aleph was the ox. And the ox's head was written simply just with that triangular face and two horns. So it kind of looked like that, right? And the ox was the strongest domestic animal, the largest, the most powerful. And so to them, Aleph, ox, meant the strongest or the greatest of something. And so wherever you see Aleph, you know that that meaning is embedded someplace. And so the name of God, the name of the Hebrews' God, originally was El. And the Aleph could be represented either by an A or an E. This gets very complicated. Just trust me on that. And the next letter, the Lamed, the El, was a staff. And so the staff was the staff of the shepherd that led the flock. And so Al, or El, literally means a strong leader. And that's how they saw their God, as a strong leader. But they put him into the plural, Elohim, because in Hebrew, plural could signify the greatest of something, not just more than one something. But they all also understood that their God was more than just one something. He was a unity of multiple things functioning as one. But that El, that Al, that strong leader, was the first understanding of who their God was and how he functioned in their lives. He was their leader, their shepherd, their guide, as well as their disciplinarian at times, of course, right? So then we come to the name of Father, and Father is Ab. We still have that same Aleph, that same idea of the strong leader. And I forgot to mention, at some point in history, these pictograms and these letters of the alphabet, they just rotated and nobody really knows why. It's just as you walk and you look at these manuscripts over time and what's left in stone carvings, suddenly this ox's head turned around this way. And what does that give us? It gives us our letter A. And the same thing with the bet, or the B of the Ab. It was a picture of the floor plan of the Hebrew tent. And the tent had an opening in front, and it had two sides with a wall down the middle. And one side was the women's side, and the other side was the men's side. And so if you picture that, it looks like our B turned on its side again. You have the two halves of the tent. And Ab literally means a strong house. The bet being the house, or the tent of that nomadic people. And so the strong leader in their God, the strong house, the father was understood as the one who gave the stability to the house. He was literally the tent pole that held up the tent. He created the umbrella and the covering for his family. He went out and he provided and he produced and he allowed everything, all the life to occur inside of that bait, that tent. So now we come to mother. And mother is M. And that E sound is still the Aleph, still the strong. And the Mem, the M would be our analog, was literally originally just the ripples of water. And so Mem literally means water. And so Mother literally means strong water. Well, what in the world are we talking about there? Strong house makes sense. Strong water. When the Hebrews would render the hides of their animals, and they would boil them first in order to get the leather that they would need later on, a thick, sticky residue would rise to the surface as the skins were being boiled. And they would scrape that off, and they would literally use it as a glue or an adhesive to bind things together. And so strong water literally meant the glue that holds the house together. Isn't that beautiful? The Father is a strong house. The Father is the one who gives the rigidity and the covering to the family. But the Mother is the one, she's the glue who holds it all together. Do you see how that works? Our mothers are the ones who are concerned mostly with relationship, with making sure that the house functions as a home. The Father may put the roof over the top, but it's not a home. What was that song? There's no home while she is away. I'm hearing it. Bill Withers, go with me on that one. It's no home when she is away. That's the one. The woman is the one who does that. She's the glue. And then we get to the brothers, the Ach. And it's a really weird thing to say, but it's still Aleph, still strong, but then the Chet, which is our analog of an H. And originally, that symbol for the H sound was a picture of a wall, the uprights with the slash through it, of which we just have one, but there was a series of them in the original Chet. And so a brother was literally a strong wall. They were the ones who created the perimeter. They created the barrier. They created the protective front for the family. Because remember, these families all lived together. They formed the first clans and tribes, and so the brothers were literally the army of the tribe. They were the protectors and the defenders. And so the brothers were the strong wall. And then the word for son, Ben, it would be Beit, the same house, and then Nun, which is our N, but the original pictogram was of a germinating seed. So you had the seed head and you had the beginning of a plant shooting off of it. And so literally it was the seed of the house, or the house that continues. The children, the son, daughters as well as sons, were seen as the continuation of the house. And then if you add A-Y-A on the end of that, Ayah, which literally means without limit, Banayah, Ben plus Ayah, meant generations, meant the children flowing down through the generations. Hardwired into the very fabric of the Hebrew language are the roles that we play. All of us, still to this day. Technology erases some of the necessity for these roles, but they're still right under the surface, and we feel them at times. Everybody can push an accelerator and push a button, pull a trigger. But underneath that, right under the veneer, are still the necessity for these roles if there is to be human life as we understand it. And it's right there in the language. And I don't know if some of you women feel a little bit short-sheeted sometimes, because God is always referred to as a man, always as masculine. But at some level, we already know and we understand that God is both male and female, masculine and feminine, and neither at the same time, because he's spirit. But the other major concept that the Jews understood is that things weren't separated into compartments. Things weren't opposite, mutually exclusive. It's like we think of good and evil and light and dark and male and female and matter and spirit, but they saw everything as a unity, as a connection, as a continuum. And so the idea of masculine and feminine and father and mother were necessary and complementary, alternating forces, both that needed to be present in order for life to be whole, to be complete. The Hebrew idea of good and evil as ripe and unripe, a continuum between immaturity and maturity, between the inability to do what we were designed to do and the ability to do just that, is part of that. The idea of light and dark, of day and night, yoma and layla, day and night, are these alternating alternatives. The daytime, the place of straight rays, of clarity, of understanding, of illumination, where we go out and we do something, has to be alternated with the nighttime, the time of dreams and introspection, of assimilating what we have learned. It's represented by curved energies, like wind and water. In Genesis 1, where God is, the Spirit of God is hovering over the face of the deep, and it's a formless and it's void. That chaos is not darkness as we understand darkness. It means without form. Just curved, unformed energies. When God says, let there be light, it's interesting, sometimes people really feel that's absurd, because he says, let there be light, before he creates the stars which give the light. But what he's literally saying is, let there be order. That's what the light, Aor, represents. Not visible light as much as order, as harmony, as something upon which to build. Out of the chaos comes order. And these two things are necessary. We need a little chaos in our lives. We just don't need to go looking for it, right? But it is that time where we let things break down, where we move into what the Aborigines call dream time, that gives clarity and gives meaning to the straight rays of Nura, of light. And so these necessary things, these complementary energies are necessary. And the Jews understood father and mother needed to be together, and they saw their God in the same way. Yes, they referred to God in the masculine, but they also understood that he had a feminine side as well. And that feminine side is literally personified as Chokhmah, which means wisdom, divine wisdom. And always Chokhmah was understood as feminine, as female. In Proverbs 20, you see this all played out. If you want to go to Proverbs 20:21, so they'll know I'm not making it up there, Frank. Wisdom shouts in the streets. She lifts her voice in the square. She lifts her voice in the square. At the head of the noisy street, she cries out. At the entrance of the gates of the city, she utters her sayings. And on and on and on through Proverbs, you will see this personification of wisdom as a woman, as feminine. And that wisdom was understood as a female energy, as a place of connection. And this is what was so important for us to understand as we go further here. God was understood as Echad, as one. But one was not one thing. It was multiple things functioning as one. So father and mother functioned together as one thing, one energy. And so literally, is there an our mother as well as an our father? And how does that work? It works because wisdom, you probably heard it defined this way, is the application of knowledge. Heard that one before? Knowledge is the gathering of facts. It's the gathering of information. That's a very masculine trait, to go out and acquire, to grab things, to go out and make things happen, to acquire this knowledge. But without the application, without the experience of how that knowledge works in relationship, in the interaction in our lives, knowledge can be a dangerous thing without wisdom. Would you agree? Knowledge is having a lot of things to say. Wisdom is knowing when to keep your mouth shut. Think about it that way. Wisdom is what gives wings to the knowledge. It makes it work for us in ways that further the life, the preservation of life of everyone. So knowledge is accomplished. Wisdom is experienced. And when the wisdom is experienced, it's a deeper knowing. The word for know in Hebrew is yada, which means hand. So they understood knowing as handling something, having experience with it, not just understanding something intellectually. So how can God be both father and mother at the same time? You know, it's a difficult concept for us. And it might sound, I don't know, even blasphemous, or it may make you uncomfortable to think of God as mother as well as father. But think about this. The earth is round and the earth is flat at the same time. How is that? The earth is round in fact. It's actually a sphere. But it's experienced by each one of us as flat. In our daily life, we look out and we see flat earth. In our experience, it's flat, even though we know that it's round. God is the strong house. God is the one who is the builder of the heavens and the earth. He is the one who goes out and accomplishes things. He is truth personified. He is knowledge in fact, masculine. But God is also strong water in experience. He's strong water in the experience of our daily lives. We experience God moment by moment, not as the creator of the universe, but as the mother into whose arms we can fold ourselves. We experience God as this relationship. And what we take away from that experience is the wisdom that gives wings to the things that we know, allows us to use those things we know in ways that can again profit everyone that we meet. We are able then to leave people better than we found them when we've experienced Emma, Mommy, as well as Abba, Daddy. And what Jesus did when he started calling his Father Abba, Daddy, he was talking about the relationship that he was experiencing with him, this intimate relationship that is both father and mother. Jesus called his Father in heaven that. He experienced Chokmah. He experienced this relationship probably first with his own mother. Did you ever think about that? Brennan, my 7-year-old who ran around here giving the candies out this morning, he's still pretty much a mama's boy. In fact, 9 times out of 10, when he comes to see me, the first thing he wants to know is, where's mom? That's the way it works with him. He is attached to his mom. And you know what? That's as it should be. We first experience life as unity. The infant doesn't know that mom is not a part of him or herself. The infant experiences the connection. Mom is an extension of him or herself. And there is no understanding of how these things break down. From there, we grow into that intellectual understanding. We grow into Father's world. Out of Mother's world, we move into Father's world. We are looking for clarity. We're looking for information. We're looking for ways to build whatever it is we feel we need to build in our lives. But what Jesus was here to tell us is that you must become like little children again in order to enter the kingdom, in order to be kingdom. And what he's talking about is a return to Mother's world, but bringing with you the aspects of Father that you have gleaned along the way. To volitionally, to submit back into that dependent, vulnerable, connected relationship that we had as children with our mother. If we can't do that, we can't understand what it means to be in God's presence. We cannot experience kingdom. We can't be kingdom until we make that circuit, that complete journey. And this is what Jesus did. Take a look. Let's just read a couple of chapters of experiences of Jesus with his mother. There's so few of them in the New Testament. Jesus interacting with his mother. But the few that are there are instructive, and they give us the milestones of Jesus' journey. At Luke 2:41, "And now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when he became 12, when Jesus became 12, they went up there according to the custom of the feast. And as they were returning, after spending the full number of days, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem." Every parent's nightmare, right? "And his parents were unaware of it, but supposed him to be in the caravan, and went a day's journey, a whole day's journey. And they began looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances." Doesn't that tell you something about life? You know, that it was okay. You know, there is no word for cousin in Hebrew. Did you know that? Everybody was a brother or sister. There was no distinction made between the children of your brothers and sisters. They were all brothers and sisters. And so Jesus just being among the caravan, among the family, was good enough. The parents didn't need to know exactly where he was. Those little things add so much color and so much reality to life as Jesus was experiencing it growing up. "So after a day's journey, they start looking for him among their relatives and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem looking for him." This is now day 2 without Jesus. You mothers, you fathers too. 2 days, not knowing where a child is. Going all the way from your little town in the back of beyond to the big city, and you've lost him for 2 days. The panic that is rising from the pit of your stomach up into your throat. "Then after 3 days now, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when they saw him, his parents, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us this way?" Isn't that the perfect Jewish mother's response? "Why have you done this to us? Why have you done this to me? Behold, your father and I have been anxiously looking for you." And Jesus said to them, "Why is it that you were looking for me? Did you not know that I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand the statement which he had made to them. And he went down with them and came to Nazareth, and he continued in subjection to them. And his mother treasured all these things in her heart. Have you ever wondered what Jesus knew and when he knew it? You know, we understand him as God, and some of us, you know, relate that to be or have been taught that even as an infant, Jesus knew exactly who he was and had some sort of cognition and ability to process information far beyond his years. But at verse 52, right here, you know, in the next verse, Luke says that Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. He goes home, he stays in subjection to his parents, but he grows in wisdom and stature. Jesus grew. Jesus learned. If he grew at all, then you can move the timeline backward and realize that there was a time when he knew less than he did at some other time. This is the implication to me. This is the clue that Jesus grew up like any child grew up. He started as a helpless infant. He started in that place of pure connection with his mother. But by age 12, which was the age of the bar mitzvah, the age where a boy became the son of the law, which is literally what bar mitzvah means, and became accountable for his own actions, you see him beginning to pull away. You see him starting to exercise the movement from mother to father. "Didn't you know I needed to be in my father's house?" he says to his mother. He needed to move from that relationship to the next. But he is pulled back and he stays in subjection, but he keeps growing and learning about his father's house, learning what it means to live in the father's world. And then years later, at John 2, 1 to 5, on the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there, and both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And you have to understand about Jewish weddings, they were week-long affairs. They were huge. They were probably the biggest thing to hit a village. Everybody looked forward to them. You know, they were the main social event. They were huge. And so if you were hosting a wedding, that meant all eyes were on you. And everybody was there in a small village. Big deal. So when the wine runs out, this is a major faux pas. Renee, you would never let that happen, I know. Renee's a planner and she does these things. But the wine runs out, and the mother of Jesus says to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come." Sounding kind of impertinent there? Sounding like Jesus not really respecting his mother? He's trying to give her a message, though. The separation, the movement away from the mother's house into the father's house is now becoming more complete. But what does mom do? She knows her son. She turns and says to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." And of course, you know the rest of the story. He turns the water into wine, his first miracle. He obeys his mother, but he lets her know, "Woman, things are changing here. I am not the mama's boy anymore. I have to be about my father's business." And shortly after that, he goes to the river to be baptized by his cousin, his brother John. And after that, the Spirit drives him into the wilderness where he stays symbolically for 40 days and encounters three symbolic temptations: to turn stones into bread, to bow down before the adversary and become the leader of all the kingdoms of the world, and to throw himself down from the parapet of the temple into the court where all the people would see, only to be borne up by angels. And Henry Nouwen has a beautiful way of looking at this. He says, those three temptations are symbolic of the major drives that drive each one of us as human beings. To turn stones into bread makes you relevant. Don't we want to be relevant? Don't we want to matter? Don't we want to have something that people need? Something that connects us to them in a grassroots way? And what does that better than food? And to be the king of all the kingdoms in the world, that's the need to be powerful. to be able to exert control over your circumstances, to bend them to your own advantage, and to throw yourself down and be borne up by angels in front of all the people in the courtyard is the need for us to be spectacular. You know, we want to stand head and shoulders above the crowd. We want to be somebody. Jesus had to work out those kinks in his own human nature, just as everyone else does. And every one of those temptations, he finally faces down, and he faces it down with God's word. He faces it down with the connection to his Father's Spirit. But he has to do it alone. He can't do it with his mother at his side. It's a rite of passage that he goes through. Have y'all ever heard of the four stages of spiritual growth? Actually, different people who talk about the stages have different numbers, but the ones that I like the best are from Scott Peck, and he talks about four of them. And the first one is the natural person, the person who basically operates for themselves, almost in an amoral way, certainly not in an ethical way necessarily. They are out to get what they need, and they will step over anybody in order to do it. And to me, that shows an identification with the self. The person is identifying themselves with that voice in their head that tells them all the things that they need and all the things that they don't have and impels them to go out and get it. Even if that person is religious, even if that person is in the church, they're still a predator of sorts because they are looking to fill their own needs. But if you move another stage up, this stage, the person is identified not with self anymore, but now with the group. In the context of a church, that's someone who has really drunk the Kool-Aid. That's someone who really believes the theology of the church and identifies with the group. But it doesn't have to be a church group. It could be any group. The person who's the company man. The person who loves the sports team, the person who is of a particular political party. When you identify with the group, then you follow religiously all that the group does. You know, especially in religious terms, but not necessarily only. These people become more rigid because it's the group that gives them the sense of security. They no longer have to go out for themselves and get it. The group provides that for them, and they build the walls around their group really thick. And if you are chipping away at that in any way, you will feel the wrath of the person who is in a stage two type of relationship. Trouble is, relationship with the group is not enough. Even if it's with your family, it's not enough to sustain you when life mugs you. And eventually, life always mugs us. Something happens that takes us to our knees, and we find out that the faith that we had in this thing, in this group outside of ourselves, is not sufficient to carry us through. And the disillusionment that comes out of that throws us into stage three. And stage three is a time of searching. It's a time of questioning everything that you thought you knew. Often people will self-describe themselves as atheist or agnostic. They've lost their faith and they're searching for something new. If we take a look at Jesus' life, we see those stages already there. You know, as a child, every child is narcissistic. Every child is looking for their own needs to be met. Jesus moves from there into an identification with his family, with the larger religious culture that surrounds his family. But at some point, he is forced out into the wilderness, into the desert, and he needs to go through his own search, and he needs to find out who he really is. And when he comes out the other end of that into his public ministry, he understands that, and we see it evident in everything that he does. He has moved into what is called the stage four, where the identification is now fully with God's Spirit. People in stage four can flow between different faith traditions and find the commonality rather than the divisions between them. They don't have to worry about their walls being chipped at because what they now identify with cannot be taken away. It is immutable. It is God, the same yesterday, today, and forever. And Jesus comes out of that experience a changed Jesus. He grew in wisdom and stature. Now take a look at Matthew 12, and we see evidence of this. While Jesus was still speaking to the crowds, behold, his mother and brothers were standing outside seeking to speak to him. And someone said to him, your mother and your brothers are standing outside seeking to speak to you. But Jesus answered the one who was telling him and said, "Who is my brother? Who is my mother? Who is my brothers?" And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, "Behold my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my brother and sister and mother." His identification had changed from family, from culture, from the things of the group, into pure connection with his Father. It's beyond blood. It's beyond theology, beyond doctrine, beyond customs, beyond anything that limits. Jesus had grown and said, "Whoever is with me, identified with my Father's Spirit, he, she is my mother and brothers and sisters." A different type of identification. Still seen through the eyes of his mother. How did that make his mother feel? How did it alter the relationship he had with her? Not at all. Jesus is making a point here. He's trying to get a people so focused on blood and bloodlines, you know, Banaya, their generations, themselves as identified as an ethnic group, as opposed to all those other groups. He's trying to get them to see, look, there's a different type of identification here. Jesus could identify with and connect with Romans and with Samaritans and with all of the people who stood outside the law within his own culture because he had this identification. He had moved now from his mother's house to his father's house, and he was moving back to his mother's house, bringing his father's house with him. The merging of the two that seemed to be opposites to us, bringing them together. But it didn't change his relationships. It didn't change his sense of duty and his connection to his family. And when he's hanging on the cross at John 19:26, when Jesus sees his mother and the disciple whom he loves standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own house. Here's Jesus at the end of his life making sure that his mother is cared for, creating a new bond that would survive him physically so that his mother was cared for. He loved his mother. He never abandoned her. Even as the identification was changing in terms of his deep spiritual sense, he still loved his mother. He was still there for her. This is so important for us to understand because our journey needs to mirror Jesus' journey. He told us, "If you will do what I have done, if you will follow my commandments, you are my followers and you will know the truth and the truth will make you free." We need to mirror this in ourselves. And how do we do that? How is it that we can do what Jesus was doing? I want to read you just a couple of paragraphs from a book called Our Father Abraham by Marvin Wilson, where he talks about the difference between Hebrew thought and Western thought. And if we can start to get some of this, we too can start to move down this path where we can start to reintegrate our mother into our father. He writes, "The Hebrew knew that he did not need," let me try that again. "The Hebrew knew that he did not need to know all the answers. His position was under the sun, that is on this earth. So his words were few. He refused to over-systematize or force harmonization on the enigmas of God's truth or the puzzles of the universe. He realized that no one could straighten what God had made crooked. All things, therefore, did not need to be fully rational. The Hebrew mind was willing to accept the truths taught on both sides of the paradox. It recognized that mystery and apparent contradictions are often signs of the divine." Isn't that great? The paradox itself is a sign of the divine. Not trying to figure it out all the time. We are obsessed with trying to figure things out, but to leave things unresolved, leave the paradoxes sitting by side, is the sign of the divine in Hebrew thought. Stated succinctly, the Hebrews knew the wisdom of learning to trust in matters that they could not fully understand. And there's the key word trust, to trust without rationally understanding. The Semites of the Bible times did not simply think truth, they experienced truth. As we have previously emphasized, truth is as much an encounter as it is a proposition. This experiential perspective on reality explains, in part, why Judaism never really developed vast systems of thought. It also allows us to understand how Judaism could live with the tensions and paradoxes surrounding block logic. To the Jew, the deed was always more important than the creed. You need to put that on your refrigerators. The deed was more important than the creed. He was not stymied by language that appeared contradictory from a human point of view, neither did he feel compelled to reconcile what seemed irreconcilable. He believed that God ultimately was greater than any human attempt at systematizing truth. Walking in the truth and living the truth were a higher priority than rationally analyzing the truth. In the words of the renowned biblical scholar Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, we Jews are practical. We are more interested in discovering what God wants man to do than we are in describing God's essence. As a teacher, I never try to solve questions because most questions are unsolvable. He concludes, Judaism is never afraid of contradictions. It acknowledges that full reconciliation of the two is possible only in God. He is the coincidence of opposites. I love that line, that description of God as the coincidence of opposites. We have to stop trying to think our way to God, and we just have to live our life with God out. Yes, we have to have clear thought. We need to have the straight lines of Nura, the harmony, the order in our lives so that we're not always chaotic. But if we don't realize that we need to take that into the relationship with our mother and live out the relationship, then we're going to lose everything that we set out to gain in the first place. Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father but through me. Can we start to understand the impact of that statement now? Jesus' way is the way of our mother. We can only come to the Father through our mother, through the relationship, through the daily understanding of what it means to be held in God's embrace, is the only way that we will ever know the Father, be able to live in kingdom as He created us to do. How do we do that? We do it when we are mindful of our moments, like we've been saying so often, to really be present, to connect, to get out of our heads, to stop the constant thinking about past and future and move into this timeless present. We do it when we accept contradictions and not try to constantly rationalize them and figure them out and to move along those linear lines that take us away from just understanding God as the coincidence of opposites, allowing things to just lie, to realize we're never going to understand. But if we can trust, it doesn't matter what we understand. And the only way we can trust is by experiencing the trustworthiness of God. When we can rest in the unknowing and become dependent and vulnerable and childlike again, that's when we begin to engage chokmah, to engage divine wisdom, and to move back to the Father volitionally, move back to the Father in conscious submission, not as a child does, uncomprehendingly, but now as an adult, bringing our Father with us through our mother into kingdom. This is what Jesus is trying to get to us. I want to end with an excerpt from a poem. It's by T.S. Eliot, who's one of my favorite poets. It was written in 1941 in Britain during the Second World War. Just listen for a second and see what images it might evoke. For most of us, there is only the unattended moment, the moment in and out of time, the distraction fit, lost in a shaft of sunlight, the wild thyme unseen, or the winter lightning, or the waterfall, or music heard so deeply that it is not heard at all. But you are the music while the music lasts. These are only hints and guesses, hints followed by guesses. And the rest is prayer, observance, discipline, thought, and action. The hint half guessed, the gift half understood, is incarnation. Here the impossible union of spheres of existence is actual. Here the past and future are conquered and reconciled. For action were otherwise movement of that which is only moved and has in it no source of movement. And right action is freedom from past and future also. For most of us, this is the aim, never here to be realized. Who are only undefeated because we have gone on trying, we, content at the last, if our temporal reversion nourish, not too far from the yew tree, the life of significant soil. I don't know what your reaction is to hearing something like that, just without being able to read it as well. It's probably a sense of some sort of deep and profound truth, maybe, beautiful words, but what in the heck is he talking about? You know, it's dense. I believe what he's talking about first is our mother speaking to our hearts directly. That hoshech, that wisdom in direct experience, being lost in our moments, not able to think through or reconcile things. But secondly, it's our Father. It's our working through our Father's house, trying to understand, trying to resolve these things, but finally realizing that it's not possible and falling back just into the moment, just into the passage of time. We need both Father and Mother always. But we begin our lives as physical humans with our Mother, and we begin our spiritual journeys the same way. And we end it with our Mother as well, bringing back into resolution all the pieces. We must return to our Mother, pure experience, become children again, lose ourselves in the music that is heard so deeply that it's not heard at all, because we are the music while the music lasts. Our Mother is the one who leads us to our Father, and it's the only way we can come back home. Let's pray. Father, thank you for our mothers. Thank you for the physical relationships that give us clues into the spiritual relationships that remain unseen. Help us to dive into our physical relationships and our families and our friends so deeply that we begin to learn exactly what the relationship with you is like, because you've told us that's where we'll find it, right here, right now, in kingdom. Keep us focused, Lord, on this moment. Keep us ever mindful of the love of the others around us and our desire to return that love in any way that we can. We love you because you first loved us, Father. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.